Succession, number 28750, Reel 4.
Laurie Manton, Reel 4.
It's quite astonishing, because if you looked in the direction of Baghdad and looked at this lot, what had happened was that when they started getting attacked, the Iraqis run off to the left into their own minefield and were all blown off in bits along there. And those that ran off from the open desert to the right were pursued individually by American helicopter gunships and blown to bits. I found an American Army Graves Registration Unit on the left. And they said, "Do you want to come out and see us pick up? There's a body out there." And we got out there, walked along a cleared path. They put down a body bag, and there was about 12 of them, and they walked in different directions to pick up the bits of this Iraqi and brought the bits back, put it in the bag, and then got rid of it. And I was quite interested to see a documentary about 5 years ago which actually showed that. So that was, I hadn't realised that was captured on film. And at the same time, there was a famous American photographer working for Time magazine who was in a helicopter, and the great Time Life book on the Gulf War, the frontispiece is an aerial view of the wrecked convoy with a British combat engineer tractor with four by four vehicles going through the minefield on the side. So we were also photographed from the air, but it was surreal in the convoy there. And I remember walking along and saying to my photographer, "Photograph everything. You know, we'll never see anything like this ever again." I said, Mike, look, there's a foot." And there was a bare foot with an ankle stood in the road. Yeah. So Mike's taking his photographs. I'm filling my boots because I have dozens of rolls of film on me. And walk along, there's a minibus with a door open, and a guy stood next to the door. "Yeah. Are you all right?" And went over, and the guy had just got out at the time of the attack and had died for some reason, whether he was killed by the blast or shot, but his arm was through the open window of the minibus, and there he still stood. Then we went on a bit further, and there was a guy who'd obviously been set on fire, and you know, he was burnt to death. But it's quite interesting because all his skin had bubbled, so it looked a bit like a Hiroshima or Nagasaki burns victim. But the material of his belt must have been flame retardant, so this completely burnt body had an absolutely perfect unburnt belt round it, and the green of the uniform under the belt was still there, so everything else was burnt off. And a photograph of that appeared in a Kodak book of photography and won an award for some American who also photographed it. But that was the sort of extent of the bodies. And then I said, "Well, let's get in amongst these vehicles." And that's where I started taking photographs. And this is why I call it surreal. Because the Iraqis had looted Kuwait City to such an extent, they were taking everything back with them. They'd thrown away the ammunition. So as a wrecked Iraqi army lorry with the tail flap down, spilling out of that pile to the roof, and spilling out of it and onto the ground behind, was all plastic flowers, bunches of plastic flowers. Yet, what a thing to see, a spectacular sight for photography. And I turned round, and there was a Iraqi denim gas mask holder, little denim canvas bag. But sticking out of it were 2 feet with shoes on. It was a doll. Thrown away the gas mask, thought my child had liked this doll and put the doll in there. But it looked like the doll was in its own body bag. What a photograph, you know. So this is the sort of unusual thing that I was photographing. Yeah, the body site still stay with me, but they're dead. But the flowers and this doll's feet sticking out of the this canvas bag, you know, and it was like that.
Like Salvador Dali, isn't it? These surreal paintings he used to do.
But, unbelievable.
I suppose when you're in that situation, am I right? You know, it's very surreal and horrible, but it must be fascinating as well when you get things like that. Do you get above it?
It's not horrible. It would be horrible if they were wounded. Because if people are screaming, that's what's distressing. What distressed me was when I wrote the story and sent it back and it appeared and there were no photographs of it. And my photographer had pretended to take photographs, even though he was the photographer, because he didn't want to be involved. Which I think was fairly criminal, but being a good civil servant, then he couldn't be got rid of. But, you know, to me it was, you know, there's a nice photograph of some sweet biscuits on the table, or there's a badly burnt body, or there's a foot. It's a photograph to be taken, and you're completely and utterly detached from it. Completely detached. And indeed, when they set up the UK camp and we started travelling, we had interviewed a guy, a British soldier, in his armoured vehicle, who said he'd been driving along one of the roads towards the coast in Kuwait, and they passed an ambulance that had been shot up, Iraqi ambulance, and the body was lying out the back. And as it went by, one of the crewmen said, "It moved." So he went and grabbed this guy, a wounded Iraqi, and half his brain was missing, and he was, you know, just staring at them. And they laid him on the louvers, the grill on top of the engine, as they drove him off to the British Field Hospital, and the warmth revived him. And by the time they got back, he only had half a head on top. He was chatting with them and having a cigarette, speaking in perfect English. Well, I drove out, and I thought, there's that ambulance. And I went, stopped, had a look round, and I looked to the right, and there were three bodies, and they said there were three other bodies. So I went down and documented the bodies. Now, people will say, well, it's really ghoulish, but it's a bit of history, and someone needs to document it. And I actually documented those bodies over a period of 3 weeks, because at night, even though the British would bury them, at night the desert dog packs would come in and then start stripping the meat from the bodies. So my set of photographs takes them from when they were reasonably whole and recognisable to when, for example, you know, the whole rib cage was exposed and the contents had gone, and then the face was stripped from the skull, you know, all the skin was taken off by the dogs and all the rest of it. Now, there are so few photos like that. But it wasn't distressing to see those bodies as they went. And there was one other body that I did document, which was, we found a burnt out four-wheel drive vehicle, and then one in reasonable condition further up the road. Some had obviously burnt to death in the back of it because there was a jawbone with teeth. But the other one was an Iraqi sat there behind the wheel, like I'm sitting before you now, but a hole in his forehead just above his nose. But as the body broke down over the 2 week period that I was regularly around there, then the brain turned to jelly and then started to ooze out of the hole. But it looked like cold porridge. And by the end of the 2 week period, the dead guy's lap was full of porridge, and his head was obviously empty. But that, you know, that's the sort of thing that was around.
I suppose, really,
but hardly documented.
Yes,
at all.
The reality of war, isn't it? Yes, would these have been shown, your photographs? You know,
I use them on my slideshows. And I said, you know, if anyone, I always used to say it was a military enthusiast club or a Royal British Legion club or something like that, and I'd say, I'm now going to show you some photos. It wasn't a video game, like it seemed to be when Norman Schwarzkopf was saying, and here's a film of the luckiest guy alive crossing the bridge and then it blows up. I said, got children who don't want to see it, etc., etc., then leave now, and then I show them. And no matter what age the people were, they come up to me after and say, thank you very much for showing those. We realise, you know, it wasn't the game it all appeared to be. But no, I always shone them big on the screen and never received any criticism for doing so.
Yes, war is depicted as very sanitised, isn't it?
Mm.
That war in particular. You know, I think there was one photograph, wasn't there, of a burnt out body behind a steering wheel.
With the teeth, yeah. That
yes,
was,
did you see that one?
Yeah, that was Ken Jarecki's photograph, which I thought was stunning. But if you actually see that in context, that photo, because that's not the only one he took, stunning image. But in actual fact, behind him, the truck was full of burnt people hanging out the back because there was loads of them killed. It's just that image of where the teeth were and grinning, then it made the picture. And that was about the only photo that was published, because the picture editors of the Nationals in the US and the UK were squeamish and felt they couldn't show it. There's a big hue and cry over that photo, but I think it's absolutely justified in showing it.
Yes, I know a lot of people thought that at the time. It was very controversial, but it brought people up to the reality of it, didn't it? The sort of thing you're doing.
Well, it's interesting because I'm just trying to think where... There was a war artist out there called Robin Watt. And after the war, he was commissioned by the National Army Museum to produce a book of his drawings to sell in aid of military charities, and he hadn't drawn any of the bodies, and he said, have you got any? So I lent him my body photos, and he did half a dozen really accurate representations of these very good artists. And when we went up to the opening at the National Army Museum, Rupert Cordonley was there and various other people opened the exhibition. At the end were these six paintings, which were taken from my my photographs. But the National Army Museum wouldn't put them in the book. They displayed them in the exhibition, but wouldn't put them in the book in case they offended people, which I was very very sad about. That was unnecessary censorship, because you can't have, you know, photos of wrecked vehicles and, you know, troops with banners flying from their tanks and such like, and not acknowledge that there's a human cost to it as well.
Yes, it gives people a false idea of what war's all about. You know, this horror, the horror of it all, doesn't it?
Mm. But we were very lucky because we went on from there, and we took the slow drive into Kuwait City as the Saudi forces were coming out of the city to move north into Iraq. And we parked up by the side of the road. A little boy rang across and said, for you, mister. And he handed us a hand grenade, which he found by the side of the road. So we were all unimpressed with that. And then we actually got down into Kuwait, and the celebrations were still going on. Everyone was going mad, and we saw the Omani embassy reopened because we could do what we want. We just drove around. It was very difficult because we had a fault with our vehicle, and it kept backfiring every time we slowed down. sounded like a gunshot. Every time it came to a bunch of armed military people, it would go bang, and we were lucky we weren't killed. So we came back out, and we saw a street party going on. We went and invited to join the street party, and the girls danced with us, and then the men danced with their swords. And the main organiser of this was the professor of English at Kuwait University, and that was very nice, and the girls wrote us little letters and fashioned us red roses out of bits of coloured paper, because we felt a bit cheap over it. We were considered conquering heroes, even though we were there as a reporter and photographer. And we drove on a bit further, and we parked up by the side of the road, and a whole load of kids came over. Now, Mike, the photographer, walked about 200 yards down the road to photograph a tank that was half up on the barrier. And these kids said, "You're really hungry. Have you got any food?" And I said, "Yeah, I've got, you know, some chocolate and some biscuits." It's about 30 of them. And I opened the back door, and they went mad. And they ran over the top of me. So desperately hungry were they, and started grabbing everything in the vehicle, including my bags of exposed film and everything. And I'm screaming to Mike, "Help." It's completely out of control. I've never been so frightened in my life. Mike. Regrettably, and it's not his fault, Mike's deaf and lip reads. So he was completely oblivious. And they stripped the vehicle entirely, everything, all the rest of his cameras and our clothing and everything else. Imagine his face when he turns around and sees a riot going on over everywhere. Okay, what is he? Taking a lot of stuff. So, you know, we line them all up and said, "Put the stuff down. We've got the film and the clothing and the cameras and such like. Take the food." But until that moment, I've never realised, you know, I've looked at the reaction of people in all these countries in the East and such like, and it's not a racist comment, but I've always thought that they're not civilised people, where they're on the streets and they're jumping up and down and rushing around and waving like that. They don't abide with normal human rules, and that's why I describe it that. But it's the first time I've come across it, and that was the most frightening thing that's happened to me. And that was little kids of 8, 9 and 10. Unbelievable. Uncontrollable, they were. Uncontrollable.
What was the state of Kuwait City?
Very bad. Completely trashed. Rubbish everywhere. You had to wander around some of the hotels that had been set on fire and things like this, lots of damaged vehicles around. It was just coming to life, so it was quite interesting to see that happen. And indeed, 5 years after the war, myself and Mike were asked to go back from soldiers to look at the place 5 years on, which was interesting because not only did we find the site of the street party we were invited to, we were shown a block of flats on the seafront, which at the time of the re-invasion, a ship had fired a shell which had blasted into the side of these flats, and they'd never been occupied since. So we said, "Oh, can we go up there and get a photograph?" So we clambered up, and whole front of the flat, the wall had fallen off. It was like an armchair, you know, it was a living room still there, exposed to the element. And I came up the stairs, and there was a little pile of rubble there. And I looked in the corner, and I could see a doll which had laid there. It was a little doll, I thought. And I'd watched Drop the Dead Donkey, that comedy series about TV newsroom on the telly. And they had a guy there that always took a teddy bear around with him. No matter where the natural disaster was, he used the same teddy bear. And always said, "Here I am in this spoof. There's been a dreadful earthquake. and a poor Charles teddy bear lies abandoned on the ground. Or it might be a train crash, and he went on and on and did this thing. Well, I took that doll and I laid it across the rubble and took a photograph. Even though I say it myself, the photograph is stunning because the doll looks ravaged. My wife was so affected by the photo. She did a fantastic painting of this doll, and the impact is there. But Mike was saying, but you've created the photographs. You know, I said, but look at the impact. And then after I'd taken the photograph, I then put the doll back in the corner where I'd...
It's very interesting, that, isn't it? You know, the creation of photographs. I know a lot of the famous ones of World War One, for instance, people say are created.
Well,
and
especially
that is legitimate, you think?
Well, the desert photographs of the Second World War that were photographed by Chet Circus in North Africa, and they filmed as well, and this was Sergeant Chetwynd, and he and his band of photographers and cameramen were known as Chet Circus. Now, there's lots of famous film where you'll see a Crusader tank coming across the desert, and there's a big explosion next to it. Or there's a burning Nazi... or Africa Corps tank with a German prisoner coming across with his hands up and Tommy's going forward. So they were all posed out of action by Chet, and it was him that would throw the grenades at the vehicles. It created good PR or public relations photos, because if you actually try and photograph a battle, and I back in 94, I interviewed a lot of D-Day veterans for a special supplement, and one of them being Des O'Neill, who was the British Army photographer who got back the first film of D-Day because he was wounded, which appeared in the cinema. And I remember him saying, he said, if you're right in the battle, there's nothing to photograph. It's only behind the battle where things are burning and the smoke that you get the imagery, because you can't photograph bullets. Which, you know, was a really good piece of advice. And so I created the photograph of the doll, which looked like a ravaged girl on this rubble of war, which is a striking image and says something. But I'm completely happy that I fabricated it, because the rubble was there and the doll was just a few yards away. You know, which is the better anti-war slogan? A pile of rubble and a doll and some leaves. You know, I don't have any problems with having taken that sort of photograph or two, you know, or things like that.
Your photographer that you took, the official photographer, if I might say so, sounds rather feeble, in as much that he didn't actually present the real images, the reality.
No.
He was obviously subjected to the army censorship in a way
no.
that you weren't.
No.
Is that right?
He was troubled by it, and I can understand it. I can understand why he did it. What disappointed me was the fact that he hadn't said to me, I don't feel I can take the photographs. Then I would have said, give me your camera, and I would have taken the photographs. Which is why Soldier magazine hasn't got any photographs of this. But I, as a private individual, have. But, you know, I'd worked with him in Bosnia and places like that. And a better person. There's no one I would want to serve with other than him in any war ever. His mistake was saying, I'm not going to take the photographs because it's too involved.
And did he know that perhaps his magazine wouldn't accept them? Was that another point that he was?
No, I think they would have accepted them.
They would have shown.
Yeah,
some
they just
deals.
Didn't.
Yeah.
But I didn't give them the opportunity of.
Did you ever feel, you know, you were a civilian, weren't you? Mm. But in uniform. And you were depending on the troops to a large extent taking you about. Did you ever feel under any sort of obligation? And
no, because they provided us with a vehicle, so we were completely independent. So we weren't even escorted.
You weren't embedded, as they said in the Second War.
The media were. But we had...
But you were different, it
complete
seems.
Freedom.
Is that it? Yes.
The only ones to have that freedom.
Yeah. I think you were dealing also, am I right in thinking this, Laurie, with the reports that were coming from people like Kate Hady and Martin Bell? Did they go through?
Well,
you?
They were coming through our area and then being transmitted via satellite. The photos would be developed at the media production centre. And then be sent by satellite back to the UK. And they were pooled pictures, which meant if someone shot a particularly fine photograph, it would be sent to all the media. So they, you know, Martin Bell and his cameraman represented all the TV companies. So there was never an exclusive, whereas the difference being my own personal shots were my shots. The soldier shots weren't pooled, those taken by Mike, the photographer. So we had this huge independence because we were just working for Soldier, which was the British Army's magazine.
So you were in the position of the, as you've described, the unilateralist reporters who were their freedom.
Yes,
but
fed, fueled and the rest of it.
Yes, but the unilateralists, were they...
Well, it was very interesting because when we were in Iraq, not far from where I'd earlier mentioned about this burning armoured vehicle with a bright blue light, we then found a petrol tanker by the side of the road which was refuelling all the military vehicles. And there's a guy in a four-wheel drive vehicle behind me. And I looked at him and I said, yeah, what are you doing out here? He said, I'm News of the World. I said, I work for Soldier magazine. He said, well, we hired a vehicle in Saudi Arabia, found some sand-coloured paint, got some second-hand army uniforms, and here we are. They'd driven up unescorted. But, you know, they could have been killed by Iraqis because they came across country, could have run over mines. But that was the first one I saw a unilateralist who'd had the good sense to masquerade as a service vehicle and you know, was getting some fantastic exclusives. Another guy called Vaughan Smith had not long retired as an army officer, kept his uniform, went out there as a news cameraman and turned up with his captain's insignia on and said to the Americans, how about me coming with you? And he did the ground war, the American troops, got fantastic fighting pictures, and that established his credentials as a war cameraman. He was a unilateralist. There was a French female photographer who I can't remember her name now, not without looking it up. She took fantastic black and white photographs. She was a unilateralist. And the other one was Robert Fisk, who's always done his own thing. But the Second Gulf War sort of saw a lot of criticism of the embedded journalists. But I think that was the only way they were going to actually have a chance to see the fighting, because it was so dangerous in the Second Gulf War. It gave them an opportunity to capture that material.
End of Reel 4, Laurie Manton.